We are now moving into what are the soft tissues of the oral cavity. We're talking about oral mucosa, tomorrow about gingiva, and then we go on to tongue, tonsils, salivary glands, and we'll end up with some less demanding topics that should not take as much out of you as what you have been doing so far. And that is as we are beginning to go into the review and study mode of this course. So today then I begin with a section on oral mucosa, and I think I will start you right off. This is going. Somebody fell? No, okay. All right, let's talk about oral mucosa and its basic components. Okay, people? Thank you. Oral mucosa is in all ways, except in some of its specific functions, very much a homologue of skin. In other words, it covers the oral cavity and it has the same kinds of components that you find in skin. In the case of the oral mucosa, we are talking about oral epithelium, not about epidermis. And we are talking about the connective tissue underneath as the lamina propria instead of the dermis. But the basic concept is the same. The lamina propria, which is of course formed by connective tissue that is originally neurocrest derived, is composed of two sublayers, a dense connective tissue layer, and a papillary layer, and we'll show you all of these different things in a moment. So this is very straightforward. If you understand the basic organization of skin, you understand the basic organization of the oral mucosa. Now, in the case of the skin, the layer of loose connective tissue that lies underneath the skin is known as the hypodermis, as you know. And in the case of the oral mucosa, there is a similar layer that is known as the submucosa. But for a variety of reasons, the oral mucosa is frequently tied very much directly to the underlying tissues, and so a submucosa is simply not always present. Let's look at the comparison. As you can see, these are two diagrams of skin and oral mucosa, and in the case of the skin, we are talking about an epidermis. Oral epithelium is the comparison layer in the oral mucosa. And then we have the dermis, and the lamina propria is the comparison layer. Hypodermis underneath here is not technically part of the skin. And the same way, the submucosa is also not technically part of the oral mucosa. It's another connective tissue layer that lies underneath, but is not part of it. When you look at the oral mucosa, and these are a series of slides from the late Dr. Segarelli, not the Dr. Segarelli that you will know next year, which is a son of his, but this is Dr. Segarelli Sr., and he had a series of slides of an oral examination, the different steps of the oral examination. And when you do that in a careful way, you can analyze and look at all of the different parts of the oral mucosa, among other things. And what you find is that depending on where you look, the oral mucosa varies. It's not all looking the same. And so you can, if you look at the inside of the lip, you get a very different appearance than when you look at the surface of the hard palate. So what you immediately begin to appreciate is that the oral mucosa varies regionally. Okay? And there are, in fact, three types of oral mucosa, two of which we will discuss today, and the last one, which is really on the tongue, we will discuss next week. What you find is that there is an oral mucosa that is known as lining mucosa, and then there is an oral mucosa that is known as masticatory mucosa, and those two types are quite different in a variety of features, and we will go over that in a moment. What you're seeing here you see actually here a boundary. This boundary here is between what we call the attached gingiva. The attached gingiva is over here. And the attached gingiva looks pale, not quite as reddish, and is also very much less movable than the tissues that you see above it. And that is the alveolar mucosa here and the labial mucosa here. Now, in this particular area, what you're seeing then is three different regions, two of which are lining mucosa, the alveolar and the labial, and one of which is masticatory mucosa, which is the attached gingiva. So this, you begin to sense that different kind of appearance. And then you have here the hard palate, which is again masticatory, looking very similar to the attached gingiva. And then a little less well shown the redness, but here's the soft palate again, which is lining mucosa. Just continue that for a while. Here is the inside of the cheek. Red, well vascularized, shiny, glistening. And then that is again lining mucosa, while the dorsal tongue is part of the specialized mucosa. So, what we then have is there are three types of oral mucosa. Lining, masticatory, and specialized. And as I said, we're going to talk about the lining and the masticatory today. Now, what are the differences between those? And the first and major difference, and that is something that you can immediately put in your mind and you will have no problem, everything else, you just know how to classify them. And that is that masticatory mucosa is always on top of a hard tissue. So in the case of the hard palate, it is on top of the palatal bone. In the case of the attached gingiva, it is on top of the alveolar process. So they're always on hard tissue. The substrate is always a hard tissue. Lining mucosa, in contrast, is lying over soft tissues. Soft tissues that can easily be pushed out of the way, that can be depressed, and any number of changes can be made. And so in this particular set of diagrams, I have lining mucosa here, masticatory and specialized mucosa. You can see that we have chosen as the tissues underneath it. In the case of lining mucosa, most often you have muscle or salivary glands or any amount of loose connective tissue. In the case of masticatory bone, or some cases part of the tooth that the masticatory mucosa lies on. The specialized mucosa is found on the dorsum of the tongue, and we will not talk about it today. But so let us look at those two types of mucosa. And you immediately see, even just looking at this very simplistic graphic, that there is a difference between the lining mucosal epithelium. It's kind of thick. And it doesn't have very much interdigitation with the underlying connective tissue. And as you will notice, it will have a non-keratinized stratified squamous epithelium. Non-keratinized. In contrast, the masticatory mucosa has a thinner epithelium, measured from the highest points of the connective tissue papillae, and it has a very deep interdigitation between the epithelium and the connective tissue. It's very deeply and sharply interdigitated. And furthermore, the epithelium is keratinized. So it's keratinized stratified squamous epithelium. So you see how the differences are. In the case of the lining mucosa, you furthermore find a submucosa. So there is a submucosa present here. There is usually no submucosa present except for specific regions, which we will outline for you. But most of the time there is no submucosa present in the masticatory mucosa. So as you can see, they are distinctly different tissues. The distribution is already self-evident because I gave you the basic guideline of how the distribution is arranged. And what you find is that the masticatory mucosa is found over here on the attached gingiva and it goes on the hard palate all the way, and it is again on the attached gingiva, and the attached gingiva here, and the attached gingiva here. Okay, so I'm kind of putting it underneath the actual, the mucosa is black, and it's indicated in black. Now, everything that is indicated in stipple, so the black is masticatory, anything that's indicated in stippled outline is lining. So that means the inside of the cheek, the mucosal lining of the floor of the mouth, and the lining of the ventral surface of the tongue. And in this anteroposterior diagram, you can see the rest of the picture, and that is again lining mucosa here and here, and lining mucosa here. Okay? It's really not hard. So if at some point, say to challenge your brain, we show you an example of masticatory mucosa and ask you where is it located, there are only two places where it can be located: attached gingiva and hard palate. That's very simple. Okay. Now, in the areas of the oral cavity, there is always a sharp division between the different kinds of mucosa. So when you look at an area where you have lining mucosa, and then you look at where there is masticatory mucosa, there is always this very sharp line. Really quite impressive. And so there are a variety of reasons why that is so, some of which have to do with the differentiation pattern of the epithelium, but also in the underlying connective tissue, very sharp boundaries between those structures. Now let's talk about the connective tissue. A connective tissue, or lamina propria, as I said, has two layers, and the two layers that we have are, first of all, the layer next to the epithelium, and is known as the papillary layer. And the papillary layer is a thin layer, loose connective tissue, highly vascular, well innervated. Underneath it, and really forming the main body of the lamina propria, is a reticular layer, which consists of very dense connective tissue, and very few blood vessels, and very little innervation. To show you the difference, here is a diagram which was made of skin, and it's the same idea. And what you're seeing here is the outline of the epidermis. This is the epidermis right here. And you see that there are connective tissue papillae that are interdigitating with the basal layer of the dermis, of the epidermis. And you find that in that papillary layer, which this is the papillary layer, you find a plexus of veins, a plexus of arterioles, and then you find a series of blood vessels, arterioles, and going back as veins, that are going into the connective tissue papillae. And so this is the first layer. This is the papillary layer. The papillary layer is very loose connective tissue, but it carries all of the blood vessels and the innervation of the lamina propria. But then, over here, underneath these superficial plexus layers of the veins and the arterioles, all you find from here on out are just some connecting veins, and venules in this case, and an ascending arteriole. They're going to the loose connective tissue below, but everything else here is dense connective tissue. This provides the strength of the layer of the oral mucosa, the same way the dermis provides the strength in this layer for the skin. So dense connective tissue, which for some reason we call reticular lamina, it's kind of a peculiar name, but that is the name that we are working on. Now, I'm going to give you a series of differences here. And the differences, even at the level of the blood vessels, exist between lining mucosa and masticatory mucosa. And what you're seeing in the lining mucosa, it's at the bottom here, these are corrosion casts of blood vessels, and you find it in the soft palate, which is an example of lining, that's already said it here. The connective tissue papillae have these very simple, very gentle looping hairpin-like blood vessels, starting as an arteriole, becoming a venule, and the return. But in the masticatory mucosa, here's an example of a hard palate, you see that these connective tissue papillae have a very intricate and very complicated vasculature. Now, you're seeing here some of the differences. I'll now begin to discuss the differences of these various layers. Let's start with the lamina propria. First of all, since the lamina propria of the lining mucosa has to have a certain amount of elasticity, whoa, those chairs sound sick. Okay. What you find is that the lining mucosa has elastic and oxytalan fibers, which are capable of assisting these connective tissue in restoring its deformation when you have pushed it a little bit out of the way. So when you have deformed the tissue, which it allows it to do because of the underlying soft tissues, the elastic fibers and also the other group, the oxytalan fibers, are present in the lining mucosa to assist that tissue in restoring that. And again, you saw that sharp line between masticatory and lining mucosa. The difference between the presence of elastic fibers in the lining mucosa and the almost complete absence of elastic fibers in the masticatory mucosa is the same kind of sharp line. So when you stain for elastic, you see lots of them in the lining mucosa, and then all of a sudden, pst, nothing there in the masticatory mucosa. In the lining mucosa, this is a subtle detail. This is the critical thing. That's what I want you to know. And this business about collagen fibril decreases and all that, there's no such decrease. Fine, it just tells you that the masticatory mucosa is better loaded. But it's not something you have to worry about. This one is important, and this one here is important. And that is that the masticatory mucosa, in general, has no submucosa, and therefore is tied very, very directly to the periosteum of the underlying bone. In fact, so much so that it forms a structure known as a mucoperiosteum, a combination of the mucosa and the periosteal layer. In fact, frequently you cannot find any plane to separate those two. So when we talk about mucoperiosteum, we're talking about an oral mucosa that is completely and firmly attached to the underlying periosteum. Now, clinically, that makes an important difference. It is very hard to find a plane to separate the mucosa from the underlying bone of, for example, the hard palate or of the attached gingiva. So when you have to do surgery, you have to be well aware of the fact that there is a mucoperiosteum and that it may be very hard to move the mucosa off the bone. So that much for the connective tissue. Elastic fibers in the lining mucosa, mucoperiosteum in the masticatory mucosa. Now let's talk interface. Interface is a very dramatic thing. I already showed you diagrammatically what it meant. But here's the example. Lining mucosa here, masticatory mucosa here. Notice the difference. I mean, if you have any visual sense at all, which you all should have because you're all future dentists, what you have to be aware of is that in the lining mucosa, there is this very gently undulating interface, occasionally a little sharp outlier, but most of the time it is a very gentle undulating interface, while in the case of the masticatory mucosa, it's really very deep, very tall connective tissue papillae, and deep epithelial structures that grow in, and we call them epithelial retipegs. I will show you tomorrow why they're called retipegs. There's actually a reason for that. Okay, so retipegs are these. These are retipegs, and the connective tissue papillae are the ones in between. So it's a very strong interdigitation. Now, why is that? The reason for that is very simple. Again, lining mucosa, in general, is not subjected to a lot of external loading. If it is loaded at all, if you push on it, it goes out of the way. It's very pliable. It tends to be deformed easily. It doesn't stand up to the load. On the other hand, the masticatory mucosa does, and so it needs a great deal of strength. It needs the strength of the connectivity between the two tissues. It needs a strength in the way of the mucoperiosteum. This is a tissue that takes an awful lot of external loading. If you want to test that out, you can do that by standing before in front of the mirror. You can look at your own mouth, and you can fold away and do anything you want with the lip. You can just move it back and forth, stretch it, do anything you want, can move it. But once you get to the masticatory mucosa, you can perhaps depress it a little bit. You can push it in and get a little depression, but you cannot move it back and forth. Try it. There's no way. Okay, so the masticatory mucosa is very much fixed to the underlying tissues, and it is of necessity very strong. Now, the same kind of strong interdigitation that you saw at the tissue level also exists at the cellular level. At the cellular level, this is lining mucosa. And you see that at the base of the basal cell layer of the epithelial cells, you have little bumps and little irregular projections, but nothing worth mentioning. But this is a picture of two epithelial cells in masticatory mucosa. And you notice that the basal layer of these cells has, in fact, very deep phyllopodial projections into the underlying basement membrane. So this is a very different kind of arrangement between the two. So this is masticatory, again, and the other one is lining. Notice the differences. And then we come to the epithelia. The epithelia are, as I already said, in the masticatory mucosa, it is keratinized. In the lining mucosa, it is non-keratinized. But as you will see, there is one rather unique activity going on. The keratinization in the masticatory mucosa is not always as complete as you see in the skin, and we'll have a name for it, and it's known as para-keratinization. We'll come to that in a moment. Let's first just talk about the basics. And what you're seeing here is now the various layers, and I know you all are aware of it. Are you a stratum layer, basal layer group or a basal layer group? Is both? Basal layer or stratum basale? Basal layer? Okay. That's the general feeling in this group? Neeraj is not. Okay, make up your mind, folks.
Both. I think both.
You're using both? Okay. All right. Well, then both of these pictures will make sense. Basal layer, spinous layer or stratum spinosum, granular layer or stratum granulosum, and stratum corneum. See, this is peculiar. They are the stratum corneum. They say in the Latin, and the rest they say in English. Okay, what the heck? It's not my diagram. Okay, I don't claim anything for it. Anyway, now what you notice is that when you look at these epithelia, whether it is a keratinized epithelium or a non-keratinized, there is a structure to it. It is much more structured than you give originally credit to. And that is that in the basal layer here has the mitoses. Okay? So you find mitoses here, and in the basal layer there is very little differentiation. The differentiation occurs in this direction. And so the epithelial cells are pretty undifferentiated in the basal layer, but they are differentiating as they move suprabasal. And that has some interesting consequences, because what you are seeing here is that the basal layers of both epithelia are very similar. And they are similar in their cytokeratins. Have you heard cytokeratins, or can I speed right through it? No? Okay. All right. Then we have to talk about cytokeratins, but let's first. Cytokeratins are one way of determining the level of differentiation of the epithelia, okay? And so basal layers in both epithelia are very similar when you look at the cytokeratin pattern, but once these cells stop dividing and they go into the suprabasal layers, they are expressing unique cytokeratins that you find only in that particular kind of epithelium. Let's look at this in a slightly greater detail. The basal cell, and we're now talking, the particular epithelial cells are known as keratinocytes as opposed to the non-epithelial cells. the basal cells are attached to the basal lamina. Okay, and you remember the basal lamina. This basal lamina is part of the basement membrane, and you have a stratum lucidum, a stratum darkum, yeah, dark layer and a light layer, and you have a reticular layer below it, and that together forms the basement membrane. The critical thing is that the cells in the stratum basale or basal layer are attached to the basal lamina by hemidesmosomes. And the hemidesmosomes are shown here in a peculiar sort of way. There are integrins on the cell surface, and they connect, that is the blue thing, and they connect to the laminin of the basal lamina. And of course the basal lamina has other things, collagen type 4, fibronectin, the whole group. Again, tomorrow we'll talk in more detail about it. But the thing that you see here, and by the way, collagen 7 is here, that is kind of making sure that the basement membrane is attached to the underlying connective tissue. It's a very intricate structure, very lovely. But what you see here, the basal cell, that's what I want to concentrate on. The basal cells are very much associated with the attachment to the basal lamina, and they are associated with mitosis. Once they are going into these upper layers, they have to make some changes. They have to reduce their dependency of hemidesmosomes. They have to be removed altogether, and they now have to start forming desmosomes to attach to the surrounding cells. In addition, they are going to form their little proteins inside the epithelium. But what you're seeing here, what is so very critical in the keratinocytes, are the microfilaments. I'm sorry, the intermediate filaments. So what we are having here are intermediate filaments, and they are the structures that are characterizing the epithelial cells to very large degrees. And the intermediate filaments for epithelium are cytokeratins. So the cytokeratins are actually the building blocks of the intermediate filaments, which determine to a very large extent the particular structure of these epithelia. Now, these cytokeratins are attached to the hemidesmosomes. They are also attached to the desmosomal plaques, and they form bundles inside the cell which give the epithelial cell a certain structure and a strength. Just to review with you what you I'm sure know, there are three types of components of the cytoskeleton. There is actin, which is essentially the muscle of the cell. There are intermediate filaments, which we are looking at here, and microtubules that are larger. The intermediate filaments are called intermediate filaments because they're 10 nanometers in diameter. What we have in the epithelium are cytokeratins of two different groups. And you have to concentrate on this picture right here, that is assembly group 1. Those are the cytokeratins. And these would be the vimentin and the desmin. The vimentin is found in connective tissue cells, desmin found in the muscle cells, and these are the lamins, which are found in the nuclei. We're not worried about those at all. But we are interested in the cytokeratins. And the cytokeratins are two groups. Type 2, which is 1 through 8, and type 1, which is 9 to 20 or something like that. Okay? And one is acid and one is non-acid, and I'm not terribly concerned about it. The way the cytokeratins form the intermediate filaments is they are always one from type 2, and one from type 1. Okay, so that is how the cytokeratins usually are found together. And they always form these little mixed combinations. This is a tetramer, four of them together. And these tetramers then assemble, and the assembly here is into an intermediate filament. Now, when you studied the epidermis, you heard about tonal filaments for sure. Yeah? Tonofilaments, does that sound vaguely familiar? God, what do you learn when you talk about epidermis? Okay, tonofilaments are bundles of intermediate filaments. Okay, so the tonofilaments of the epithelial cells are bundles of intermediate filaments. Now, the point now is that in the bottom layer, the basal layer, you have K5 and K14, sometimes K19 in the lining mucosa, minor thing. But then once the cells are going up into the suprabasal layers, we have mostly K1 through K10 for the masticatory mucosa, and K4 and K13 with the lining mucosa. It's not important that you remember the numbers. Please don't commit to memory the numbers of the cytokeratins. What is important is that you realize that in an undifferentiated epithelial cell, like the basal cell layers, there is a different cytokeratin pattern than in the differentiated suprabasal layers, and that you can tell which epithelium they're dealing with based on the cytokeratins that you're having. Now, so this is just basically saying it. K5 and K14 in the stratum basale or basal layer. When the differentiation begins, you break down the integrins and you start forming cadherins that are associated with the desmosomes. And depending on which kind of differentiation program, you get different cytokeratins. Okay. Now, in addition to the cytokeratins, there are another set of epithelia which have to do with keratinization patterns. And because of that, what you essentially find is that there is one set of proteins in a keratinizing epithelium, and they are not quite present in a non-keratinizing epithelium. However, some are present. Involucrin is present in all epithelia, even though it is considered to be a protein precursor that is involved in keratinization. So, what basic proteins do we have to worry about in keratinization? We all get to a sense here what's going to happen. Profilacrin, which will become filacrin, is a protein that assists the cytokeratins, which are the tonofilaments, in forming keratin in the superficial layers. So the superficial cell layers in the keratinizing epithelium become filled with keratin, and the keratin is formed by the combined intermediate filaments, which are forming the tonofilaments, and a combination that of filacrin. That is what forms inside the cells. What forms at the periphery of the cells are these structures, loricrin and involucrin, which together are going to form the cornified cell envelope. And the cornified cell envelope is a fantastic structure which is essentially formed by an aggregate of these. The little round things are the loricrins, and the involucrins are associated with it as well. What happens is that these proteins are going to form a cortical layer at the inside of the cell membrane during the time when they are in this stratum spinosum, and later on in the stratum granulosum. And in the upper layer of the stratum granulosum, what you're doing is you're forming this very dense mass of proteins that literally forms a barrier-like structure on the inside of the cell membrane. At the same time, that will be about 10 nanometers, just to give you some sense of what happens. At the same time, on the outside, there is another layer formed that is formed from ceramides, lipids, that are attached to that inside cornified cell envelope. So what you're having at the end of the differentiation of keratinization, what you find is that you kill all of the cellular organelles, you form this dense cornified envelope of these specific proteins, especially loricrin and involucrin, on the inside, and it is connected to the ceramide envelope on the outside. The ceramides, then, that's the last part of the story, are synthesized by the cells of the epithelium, and they are literally being extruded into the intercellular space where they become organized. And the organization occurs as follows. They start out as little liposome-like structures, and then gradually they come together and they form lamellar sheets. Now, these lamellar sheets are formed between the cells in the stratum granulosum and above. And these are now a lipid sea in which the cornified cells themselves are floating around. The net effect is that you have cornified cells, no more organelles in it. They essentially, the cytokeratins have all been packed together with the filaggrin, and you find that the cornified cell envelope here forms a very dense layer on the periphery. And in between, you have the ceramides that have formed these lipid lamellae between the cells. What is happening as a result is that the epithelium at this point, the keratinized epithelium, forms both a mechanical barrier, a physical barrier, and it forms a barrier that prevents water movement. Okay, now in the case of the epidermis, when you have that barrier, it prevents you your connective tissues from drying out, from literally losing all of the fluids. But in the case of the oral mucosa, something similar happens as well. So that is the barrier function of a differentiated keratinizing epithelium cannot be understated. And what you find is that if you put a tracer, a water-soluble tracer, below the epithelium, it will move right through up to this point where you have the barrier. And the same thing, if you put a tracer on the top of the epithelium, it will only go as far as the stratum corneum, and then it goes no further. So water-soluble materials will not move through the epithelium and cross between the epithelium and the connective tissue. Therefore, if you want to have something that crosses the epithelium, what would you look for? Something that's lipid-soluble. Because lipid-soluble materials can cross this barrier. They can be dissolved in these ceramide areas in between here. Okay, now let's go and look at a non-keratinized epithelium. What you find is that in a non-keratinized epithelium, you don't have all of these changes. You don't have the pro-filaggrin becoming filaggrin, but you do have a little bit of a cell envelope. That was the involucrin part. So the involucrin is associated with some formation, some densification of the cell membrane. And you do also have some extrusion of the lipids into the intercellular space. This is what a non-keratinized epithelium looks like. You know, I'm sure, what it does look like. And you will also remember that as the cells are moving to the surface, that they become more and more filled with fluids, that the vacuoles inside the cell kind of gradually coalesce. And so what you find is there's a lot of fluid in these cells. They become enlarged. They become like little water bags, and they resist a certain amount of compression as a result. And you find that at the periphery, the cell membrane has become strengthened by having a slight set of components of the cell envelope having developed along them. Now let's look at what happens to the epithelium of the masticatory mucosa. I told you before that the epidermis is known as an orthokeratinized epithelium. So that is orthokeratinized, but in the case of the epithelia of the oral cavity, we are talking about parakeratinized, which means that it isn't quite keratinized all the way, and there are some interesting differences between them. We do find that you have a basal layer, of course, you have a spinous layer or stratum spinosum. You have very little in the way of a stratum granulosum, so small stratum granulosum, and an incomplete keratinization. So much so that you find some of the stratum corneum to have still cell nuclei in them. So they're not quite, the organelles are not lost as much as you find in orthokeratinization. We'll look at the higher power of this, but you may notice that in this stratum corneum that there may be some single cells the stratum granulosum, that there may be some single cells with granules, but it's not even a whole layer. Here's an example of it. This is much higher power. As I said, no or minimal stratum granulosum. At best, you can have one or two cell layers, and even then, the granules are not enormous. The stratum granulosum is this precursor where you have the keratin becoming the cornified component of the cell. So what you're finding here is that there may be a little bit there, a few granules, but not as many. And then when you look in the upper layer, the stratum corneum, you find nuclei. Here's a nucleus, here's a nucleus, here's a nucleus. So they don't lose all of the nuclei. Those are the principal differences at the light microscopic level between the stratum corneum and the stratum granulosum. So, in summary then, the non-keratinized epithelium has these cytokeratins in the basal lamina and the basal layer, which is the same essentially as you find in parakeratinized. It's the same as you find in epidermis. And then you go higher up, you find differentiation with K4 and K13, a little bit of involucrin, which is associated with the cell envelope that at the periphery of the cell. But in the case of a parakeratinized epithelium, you find mostly this is K10 and 1 and 10, not 6 and 16 are not quite so dramatic. And you find here again involucrin, that's fine. But then you find provolacrin, and provolacrin, those are the granules of the stratum granulosum. So when they're present, that's what you find. And the folacrin is when you have the cytokeratins complexed with the provolacrin to become folacrin. In the case of the orthokeratinized epithelium, you find that the stratum granulosum is much more defined and that the granules are much bigger. Other than that, it's really pretty much the same. All right, now let's deal with those sharp transitions between masticatory and lining mucosae. And that has to do with the way keratinocytes proliferate and differentiate. And there is, in fact, a vertical differentiation pattern of keratinocytes. And so what you find is that once the keratinocytes in the basal layer have stopped undergoing mitosis, what you are going to find is that now, from this point forward, they are going to move into differentiation and they start developing a vertical unit, which we know as the epidermal proliferative unit. In a moment I come to that. So essentially this is actually far too far forward. Forget about this. This is the picture I want you to see. You all remember the cell columns in a growth plate. If you don't, I will beat you up. Okay? Right. Now, cell columns were highly ordered, highly organized, and they were essentially clones. Clones of a particular stem cell that kept on proliferating. Now, the same thing exists in stratified squamous epithelium. There are, in fact, in stratified squamous epithelium, a series of adult stem cells. And the adult stem cells are distributed along the cells of the basal layer. And essentially, this stem cell is somewhere at the base, somewhere in here, of the basal layer. I'll show you a 3D picture in a moment. But essentially then, what you find is that you can actually identify a group of cells, and they are literally vertically oriented, that are all a clone of that stem cell. Okay? So you have, in fact, a clonal relationship that is vertically organized inside the epithelium. And in some epithelia, it looks very beautiful. If you look for the boundaries between epithelial cells, this is the hamster ear skin, this is a rhesus monkey thoracic skin. The point I want you to see is there are actually here and here and here distinct patterns where there are these interfaces between these proliferative units. And so what you can say is, in fact, that this group of cells is a clone. It's a clone of that single stem cell that is located somewhere here in the basal layer. Now, the stem cell is undergoing very slow mitosis. It's a very slow cycling cell. But once it cycles, it now has a daughter cell, and then the other daughter cell becomes the new stem cell. And the daughter cell now is going through a series of rapid mitoses. So after the stem cell has divided, one of the two daughter cells is now becoming a rapidly mitosing cell, and we call these cells transit amplifying cells. The transit amplifying cells are undergoing rapid mitoses that quickly increase the number of cells in the basal layer. At a particular moment, some of these cells, and it is a kind of stochastic really when it happens, but there comes a moment when a cell like in this layer becomes committed. And they kind of take turns, so one cell at a time becomes committed and now goes into the suprabasal layers. And it now begins to differentiate, and it is undergoing that path of terminal differentiation. And it forms now, in this case, C1 and 10, and it is going to gradually go to the spinous layer, and then here comes the stratum granulosum, with the granules in the cell cytoplasm, and then you get the stratum corneum. And you notice that once you get above a certain level of the basal layer, these cells stack up like a stack of pancakes, so that you have suprabasal cells that form the full width of the proliferative unit. And the cells of the cornified layer are the full width of the proliferative unit. And then one after another, they kind of peel off as they shed. Here is the picture that is the three-dimensional picture. It is a crazy picture. But it shows you, this is the picture I just showed. This is the epithelial proliferative unit seen in section. But now what you have to imagine is that now you are going to look at the bottom of it, and on the other side, over here, you look at the top. So you have taken the top layer and the basal layer and kind of folded them out so that you can all see it at the same time. And now what you see, you look at the basal layer from below, and you notice that the epidermal proliferative unit or epithelial proliferative unit is essentially an hexagon, and the stem cell is located somewhere here, and now you're seeing the different daughter cell generations that are rapidly forming around here. And then these daughter cell generations go up and up and up here, and here is the shedding of the cornified cells. Because the cornified cells are all interlocked, one cell has to shed first, then the next cell can shed, then this one can shed, then this one can shed. It's a kind of an interesting dance of how these epithelial cells are shed. But you get the concept of the proliferative unit. And if the proliferative unit is vertically aligned, and you have here a proliferative unit that is going to form keratinized epithelium, and this is a non-keratinized proliferative unit, you can imagine that there is a very sharp boundary in the epithelium. That's exactly what you see. Okay? Now, epithelial cells are capable of, if you wish, temporarily reversing the terminal differentiation pattern. When you are in a situation where you have acute wound healing, there are a series of cytokines released and growth factors that between them stimulate these cells to now become more like basal cells again, and they start proliferating and they start migrating to the floor of the wound bed, where it becomes irreversible. And that is the point here at these red arrows that you're seeing here. Above the level of those red arrows, when you get into the stratum granulosum and the stratum corneum, that's irreversible. These cells cannot any longer be part of the wound healing process, but anything below that can. So when the cells of the basal layer and cells of the stratum spinosum, they can in fact migrate and start proliferating again, and in a sense temporarily reverse their differentiation pattern. So where are these stem cells located? Well, stem cells are located in interesting locations. In the case of lining mucosa, which is over here, the stem cells are just kind of distributed at even distances along the basal layer. It's very hard to find a particular pattern. But in the case of the masticatory mucosa, you find that you have stem cells at the tips of the epithelial retipegs. And so at the tips of the epithelial retipex is where you find the stem cells. And so the transit amplifying cells are all riding up on this surface here. So all of these cells here are TAs, or transit amplifying cells. And then these transit amplifying cells at some point move suprabasally here, where they undergo terminal differentiation. So these epithelial retipegs really are doing a lot of mitosis along the basal layer with the stem cells, along the slope of the retipegs with the transit amplifying cells, and there is very little differentiation until they are moving in this direction in this area. That makes these retipegs for surgeons wonderful, okay? Because what you can do if you need a skin graft, or an oral mucosal graft, you can in fact do what they call a split graft. And you can carefully dissect off this upper layer, leaving behind the epithelial retipegs, and you can use this layer here with its little connective tissue papillae in place, and you can cover the wound in another site, get good adaptation because of the presence of these connective tissue papillae that will heal nicely with the underlying connective tissue if it is healthy enough. And what you find is that the donor site has all of these epithelial retipegs which very quickly re-epithelialize the donor site. So that is known as a split graft, and works very well in epithelia where you have these deep epithelial retipegs. The final place where we talk about locations of epithelial stem cells is the junctional epithelium, and there you find them at the very deepest part of the junctional epithelium next to the tooth. That is for tomorrow. I just give you a preview on that right now. Okay, the epithelial cells that we spoke about so far are non-keratinocytes. Are keratinocytes. Let's briefly now talk about the cells that are not keratinocytes that are found in oral epithelia, the same way as in the epidermis. And you find two kinds, dendritic cells and non-dendritic cells. And they are nicely and didactically arranged. That's always very pleasant. We have two types of dendritic cells, melanocytes, which are always in the basal layer, and Langerhans cells, which are in the suprabasal layers. And we have non-dendritic cells, basically roundish cells. You have lymphocytes that can be in all layers, and the Merkel cells, which can be in the basal layers. So that is kind of a nice way to lay them out. Let's now look at them. Okay, here are the dendritic cells. This is actually a 3D reconstruction of Langerhans cells in epithelium, in oral lining mucosa. And Langerhans cells have these long dendritic processes that stick out, and they are the first sentinel for the immune system in the epithelium. So if you are concerned about antigens coming to the epithelium and possibly invading the tissues, the Langerhans cells are your first line of defense. And the Langerhans cells essentially are located in the suprabasal layers, and they extend their long dendritic processes between all the various epithelial keratinocytes, and they have sites that are capable of capturing the antigen, and then they are capable of moving into the connective tissues to the lymph nodes where they are presenting the antigens and elicit a proper immune response. So the Langerhans cells are antigen-presenting cells. They come from the bone marrow. They come to the tissue by way of the vasculature, and then they invade the tissue and just sit there and wait for action. The other dendritic cells, the melanocytes, I'm not going to go into at this point in great detail. We have melanocytes in the oral epithelium. We have pigmentation in the oral epithelium. And essentially what you're seeing here, the melanocytes, are also dendritic cells. They're neurocrest-derived. And they have this pattern of synthesis of melanin, which is it's a combination of a coated vesicle with a certain I'm breaking on the name right now, don't worry about it. There is a combination of two vesicles, coated vesicle and a vesicle from the ER. They come together, they form the precursor for melanin. The melanin is being formed. The melanin granules are then moved to the outside in the dendritic processes, moved into the epithelial cells around here, and generally found on the surface side of the epithelial cells where they are capable of protecting the cells, and especially the nuclei, against UV light. I want to continue with the Langerhans cells because what they are shown here, this particular diagram now, this is the actual life cycle of the Langerhans cells, while over here there's two black and white pictures of a lymphocyte in epithelium. Here's a lymphocyte, here's a Langerhans cell, suprabasally in both cases. And what you notice is that these non-keratinocytes, these, if you wish, visitors of the epithelial layer, they are not usually connected to the keratinocytes by desmosomes. And so what you find is that they are a little bit shrunk away. There's always a little space around them. So they can be easily identified, if you cannot see them better than that, by this shrinkage artifact around these cells. Essentially then what you're showing here is that Langerhans cells come from the bone marrow. They move by way of the vasculature to the epithelium, where they are getting out of the blood vessels, and now move into the epithelium, where they sit around and wait to be stimulated. Here's the stimulus, the antigen, coming over here, being captured by these cells. The antigen is now internalized, is prepared for presentation to the T cells, and that happens by way of the Langerhans cells going through the afferent lymph vessel to the lymph node, and when they then present in the lymph node to the T cell, you get the appropriate response there. Actually, this is a picture I really like you to see, and that what you're seeing here is something that can be almost discussed as biomimetics. The reason why we need to know a lot about the individual activities of these cells and what kind of signals they respond to, what kind of proteins they produce, the more we know, the more we can duplicate it in the laboratory as we are becoming engaged in tissue engineering. And what you're seeing here are several steps in tissue engineering. You start with a piece of dermis that has been killed, or no more cells are present, and in tissue culture you can grow keratinocytes on the surface of the dermis to form in culture actually a stratified epithelial layer. And then what you can do, you can turn this whole culture upside down, and you actually can add Langerhans precursors, which you now can find to see move into the epithelium. It is a fantastic ability to produce an epidermis that is actually already preceded with Langerhans cells. So this is, you know, these are the kinds of things that we ultimately are going to be able to have happen. Okay, the final cell that we're dealing with is the Merkel cell. Merkel cell, like the melanocyte, is neurocrest derived. It enters the epithelium, it becomes part of the epithelium, and it is found usually in a combination with mechanosensory nerves, and so it forms a little mechanosensory nerve terminal of the slow adapting variety inside the epithelium. The Merkel cell has specific cytokeratins, and one in particular, cytokeratin 20, was used here to identify the location of the Merkel cell. Notice again that they tend to be at the tips of these epithelial retipegs. And typically in the epithelium, you find the Merkel cell here. This is the Merkel cell. And here is a nerve terminal very closely associated with it. It has come through the basal lamina and forms a combination there. Now, you see here pictures of it. Here are the Merkel cells, Pacinian corpuscles. We don't have too many in the oral epithelium, but we have lots of Merkel cells, and here they are. One, two, three. They are large, pale cells. They usually stand out a little bit. And they were first discovered by Merkel in 1875, and they actually, this is the original drawing of Merkel, and you see here the nerves, very fine, I'm glad he saw them so well. That's better than most. Then you get some of these pale cells with which they are associated. Here they are again. Here's a nucleus, here's a nucleus, here's a nucleus. These are all Merkel cells in the stratum basale of the epithelium. The final innervation that we have to be concerned about, aside from the usual nociceptors, is one particular group, and that those are the Meissner's corpuscles. Meissner's corpuscles are rapidly adapting nerve terminals, again, mechanosensory, and they are located, and here's one, they are located right here in the very tip of the connective tissue papillae. And where we find them in particular, because of this particular arrangement, you can imagine that they are mostly found in masticatory mucosa, where you have these very distinct connective tissue papillae. And the area that is most richly innervated with these Meissner's corpuscles are the rugae, the palatal rugae. And you can test it on yourself. The palatal rugae are extremely sensory in nature. They are very delicately sensory. They are as sensory as the ridges of the skin on your finger. And so what you find is an interesting combination now. In the case of Meissner's corpuscles, and this is a diagram I made some years ago when we were working with robotics, and what we were trying to figure out was how do we get the appropriate sensation in robotic hands. And this one is the Meissner's terminal, and you see the Meissner's corpuscle, and this is Merkel cell with associated nerve coming in, and the combination of the two, in fact, is present in the palatal rugae, where you're seeing these Meissner's corpuscles in the connective tissue papillae, and in the deepest part of the epithelial retipec, you find the Merkel cells with their innervation. Now, that is a powerful relationship, because you have the rapidly adapting Meissner's, the slowly adapting Merkel cell complexes, and that's a combination that you have also in your fingertips, which is makes it such a useful tool to read Braille, for example. Okay, so that's what we have in the palatal rugae, and you can put anything in your mouth and detect the shape of that particular object in your mouth because of the sensation in the palatal rugae. Okay, we'll leave it at that for now. Take a 5-minute break, and then we'll have a quick introduction.